California, actually for the whole country. And in California, we feel very fortunate because we also had them write our preschool foundation. We've never had that before, where the person that, you know, worked with us is also working with the K-12, so that the alignment is just so beautiful between preschool and kindergarten now. So this is a great reference book. And then also this one, The Young Child and Mathematics by Juanita Copley, has great activities, which we use all the time for ideas. And then we love this one, Spotlight on Young Children in Math. This is an NAEYC document. It's beautiful. It's got full color examples of game boards teachers can make, all kinds of great things in here. And we use this particular book for number sense because Doug Clement says there are a lot of counting books that go 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. But the best ones are the ones that count down. Because then you know they really got the concept. So this one is 10 Terrible Dinosaurs, and it counts down. So it says, 10 terrible dinosaurs standing in a line soon began to push and shove until there were
nine,
and so on. So they make little puppets out of paper bags so the children can line up in front of the classroom and sit down each time a dinosaur down. So we've seen the teachers actually then implementing it in the classroom after we've done this with them in the training. And you know, some of these children's books are just fabulous. We don't have the kind of budget to give everyone a book, but there's always one on the table. And we do encourage folks to go back to their sites and maybe get one and share it with a few of their colleagues if they don't have a big budget to buy books. But there are some beautiful books out there, not too expensive. So any questions about the activity? Did you see the foundations and how it connects? Mm-hmm. Did you see stigmatizing on there?
Yeah. Yes.
Okay. And lots of counting, right? And even it even gets into, when you look at the foundations, adding to and taking away.
Yeah.
Yeah, you can do that, all of that, with this one little game. So I hope you come to your CPIN trainings and your network meetings wherever you live. And if you live here and you're not coming, make sure you get in touch with us and get on our mailing list and get on the mailing list of the folks that you work with in your own region, because, you know, it's a fabulous resource and a great way to connect with other folks. Thank you. How do you know they know? That's a good question.
Yeah. So what would we use as a guide to say, yes, they have this number sense?
Yeah. Well, this is a great way to, well, the DRDP is our assessment, but a game like this is a very quick assessment. Because if you have the dots and they aren't matching them correctly, you know right away they don't have it, right? Because when we were sitting with the children, right, you could tell who had it and who didn't. There's also the concept of how many-ness, which is really cardinality, that Doug Clements talks about. So we can tell immediately. We go into a classroom and we'll sit down with a child and we'll say, let's count these cars. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. How many cars do we have? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. But how many are there? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. They don't have how many-ness. But some children, you'll count them together and you'll say, how many cars do we have? 5. How do you know? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, I counted them. Then they're further along the continuum when they can do that how many-ness concept, and you can figure it out like that. So I think using your DRDPs, observing very carefully, taking notes, and if you're not from California, you can download it, and it's a really great tool. But also just playing these kinds of games. You know, we do a whole thing with Play-Doh, and we'll say, show me 4 dinosaur eggs. And they have to put 4 in the middle of the game card. Now, what would happen if we took 2 away? How many do we have now? Quick assessment. And the question, how do you know, is always when we ask with math. How do you know? Because we want them to tell us how they got to that answer. Much more important than the answer at this age.
I just want to add one little thing that we really want to emphasize with our teachers is that you can get to the point of understanding where the children are, even if they're using their home language. And many of our centers in California are very fortunate to have staff that speak the children's home language. We're a pretty diverse state, certainly the Bay Area, I think, and probably Los Angeles, and that area of diversity. So that's one thing we always emphasize, that look at the foundation. How can you see that the children can demonstrate what they know, because they can tell you in their home language, and that's perfectly acceptable. It's a little different once they enter that K-12 system. Not all districts have a dual language program, although teachers are allowed to, a certain percentage of the time can be to support children as they develop English, but we want to make sure that they don't miss that. That if that child is still learning English and they're not able to express what they know in English, the teachers need to see, well, you don't need to use home language with them. So that's just another piece of our work.
Thank you.
Well, thank you to our CPAN colleagues. We're going to shift focus a little bit here, but continuing along today with the theme of collaboration. Again, I'm Linda Livingbaum. I'm director of the California Early Childhood Mentor Program. We're another piece in the state's professional development system. I'm going to give you a brief description of the mentor program, what it is, where it came from, and then talk about the collaborations that we have done with our CPIN partners on state level as well as locally. So the program was born in 1988. If you do the math, it's 25 years old this year. And it was a partnership at that time between Chabot College, which is a community college in Hayward, which is here in the San Francisco Bay Area, and a partnership between Chabot College and the Center for the Child Care Workforce, which way back then was called the Child Care Employee Project. And it was founded to address issues that were alive in our field then and are still with us today. First is that we know that most ECE students are already working in the field when they go back to college to complete their certificates and their degrees. Research tells us that a supervised teaching experience is part of a high quality teacher preparation program. And yet for working students, completing that practicum is usually the final and last barrier. Why? They're already working. They can't easily leave their work during the day to go to the college lab school and complete their required practicum hours. So the mentor program serves as a community-based alternative to the campus lab school. And for various features, which I'll discuss in a minute, it therefore makes it easier for students to complete that practicum, graduate, and have their certificate or their degree. Other issues which the program was founded to address that are still with us is that we know high-quality teachers in our field still are not earning the respect that they deserve. Their salaries are nowhere near what they deserve. And also, once folks do finish their formal training, their higher ed training, and leave the college, usually the community college in California, they're often not connected with the latest research, the latest developments in the field. So there's a gap there, a professional development gap. So the mentor program addresses all of those features. So the pilot was developed to identify outstanding teachers in the community that work in a variety of programs under a variety of auspices with a variety of age groups in a variety of locations. And a course was written, the adult supervision course, which helps educate experienced classroom teachers with how to work with adults in their classroom. We're trained to work with children, not necessarily to work with adults. And this training is a gateway to applying to become a mentor teacher. A screening and selection process was devised that teachers would apply to, and a very close look was taken at their classroom using the Harmson Clifford Environment Rating Scales tool, other aspects of their application, philosophy statement, etc. And they could apply if they worked in family childcare, infant toddler, preschool, or school age programs. They were provided, if, once they were selected as mentor teachers, they were provided with financial assistance and ongoing professional development for them as mentors and experienced practitioners. Our program, one of our founding concepts, is linking training with compensation. Everyone who performs a role for the mentor program receives a stipend because, as we know, of the salary levels in our field. So overall, we say that we touch all pieces of the early childhood puzzle. First of all, students are happy because they find it easier to complete their practicum in a high-quality program closer to their work. Sometimes with a mentor who may speak their home language, makes it easier for that student to succeed and pass that course. And sometimes the lab school may not have offered the age group that a student might be interested in. They might, for instance, want to work with infants and toddlers, and not all lab schools offer that. Mentor-teacher programs do. Some students are interested in family childcare, and we know that center-based settings are somewhat different. Mentor teachers, some also are family child care providers. So it gives the students a broad range of options to complete their practicum. The colleges are happy because students complete those courses. They graduate. It is a higher completion rate for the college, which is important to them. The community benefits by having high quality programs identified where mentor teachers are working. And the programs themselves certainly benefit when a student is in the classroom working under the mentor teacher. There's an extra pair of hands there to help with the children and help with the classroom functions. And once teachers are selected as mentors, they share the ongoing professional development they receive with all their colleagues and coworkers at their sites. So the sites in general benefit. And the linchpin of the puzzle are the mentor teachers themselves. They earn respect for being identified as a mentor teacher. They earn stipends, a little bit of extra compensation, and they receive that ongoing professional development link that keeps them tied into what's going on in the field, latest research, advocacy, et cetera. That pilot that started at one college now has grown into a statewide reality. We are almost now at every community college that offers early childhood coursework in the state of California. We're at 100 community colleges. And in 1992, we had been funded previously by foundations. We became part of the quality improvement programs funded under the Child Care and Development Block Grant. As Nancy mentioned, we are one, CPIN is another. California has a number of large and wonderful quality improvement programs that are formed together in a professional development support system for the field. And in addition to practical mentoring, we have expanded the type of mentoring that mentor teachers do so that they offer a variety of support for students at the colleges and also some support for practitioners in the field as sort of on-site support in a very small and clearly defined way. In 1996, we added a component for directors. Previously, we only had mentoring for teachers. Now we offer mentoring both for teachers and for directors. In 2001, we moved from Chabot College to City College of San Francisco. And this year, we received a small component of California's Race to the Top Early Learning Challenge funding. Our director mentors have been trained in the program administration scale, the PASS, or the business administration scale, which is the BAS. And with those tools, they are prepared to offer support to directors, administrators, and family child care providers in the 17 regional leadership consortia that is funded through Race to the Top in California. So today, as I say, we are now at 100 community colleges. We ended last year with 646 mentor teachers all over the state of California, from the north way down to the south, east and west. We have 145 director mentors also all over the state who support other administrators. And you can see the reach among students and protege directors who were touched by our program last year. We offer, and we continue to, as when we started, we continue to offer recognition, compensation, and professional development to both mentor teachers and director mentors. Some of the collaborations we have done specifically with our CPIN partners and our PITC partners. 2 years ago at our Mentor Institute, which is an annual gathering of a representative sample of our mentor teachers, Eloisa, Debbie were the keynote presenters, so that at that time, our mentor teachers who may not have been familiar with the foundations and frameworks were taught about them. They had a chance to do a lot of interactive activities. So some of the things, one of the small activities you did here, they were able to do and really delve into the foundations and frameworks at that Mentor Institute. We're going to say more about that, that connection and that knowledge in a minute. And then last year, we also had CPIN presenters to our Advanced Director Mentor Institute, because we also want our director mentors to be aware of these fabulous resources that the Child Development Division has written and has published for the field to use to implement high quality practice. And now I'm going to turn it over to my colleague, Ellen Morrison, to talk about a specific project that the Mentor Program has engaged with the foundations and frameworks.
Thanks, Linda. I think I can just speak in front of the group here without the mic. So I hope you got the impression and the understanding that CPIN works primarily with state-funded programs. The Mentor Program works with all auspices. So we have this overlapping connection in professional development, and then the Mentor Program, which is further in one-on-one mentoring. And not only does the Mentor Program work with mentors from all auspices, but of course, mentors then work with, and director mentors work with, teachers and directors from all auspices. So where we have the luck and the good fortune of state-funded programs having the resources of CPIN training for on-site support, there are, as you know, many, many programs, a family child care program where the one teacher in the program is the owner-operator of that family child care program. Does not have any release time to go take courses, is not aware of that any of this is going on, basically. What was good enough for my mom, it's good enough for me, and those children are in the care of someone who has no education in early childhood development and is not at all aware of the frameworks and foundations or any of those materials. So our goal then is to enhance the partnership with CPIN, enhance the partnership under the umbrella of the Child Development Division, the quality improvement programs, to reach out to as many people as we can reach, as many providers as we can reach in all auspices, to let them know that these wonderful resources are out there, that they can tap into them, and that really what mentors already do, what highly qualified teachers are selected, it's a very rigorous selection process. So the only teachers and mentors who become, you know, director mentors and mentors are very highly qualified, and they already do what is described in the frameworks and the foundations as part of their process. They might not have a ready resource to say, this is what I do, and now they do. And so we want them to be able to be conversant in the frameworks and foundations, and to be able to share that and enhance their mentees and their protégés' experience with them by saying, when you leave me, you have this as a reference. You can, and many of the students, many of the college programs now are rolling out courses that integrate the frameworks and foundations that make the students aware. So when the students come to the mentors and say, so I have this to read, I don't know what this is about, the mentor can knowledgeably lead the student through that process. And so
we knew well enough that our mentors, our director mentors, are extremely knowledgeable and enlightened. So we, when we were worked with CDD and decided that we would take on this project of reaching further out into all providers, we knew to tap into the knowledge and the resources of our mentors, our director mentors. So last year we went through what we called the pilot project, in which we held a number of web conferences and conference calls with mentor teachers, director mentors, and the coordinators at our local community colleges, who are about 99% are faculty members in the child development departments in their community colleges. And we tapped into them saying, okay, so if you wanted to get these resources out to all family child care providers, all privately owned providers, how would you go about this? And how would you like to learn more about the frameworks and foundations if you're not aware of them now? And our mentors and director mentors said, you know, what we want to do is be able to share our knowledge. There are some mentors, such as our College of Marin mentors, who are already deeply engaged in implementing the frameworks and foundations programs and projects in with their classrooms, and they discuss them in their mentor seminars. How can the mentors in San Bernardino, can we learn from them? How can they get ideas about how we can play the dinosaur game? How can they then pass this on? So our mentors, and we decided to take our first step with our mentor teachers. Our mentors voted for a blog, for an online communication that they can then share videos, share ideas with one another, share resources with one another across the state. And our mentors never actually have the opportunity to all meet in person, all 646 of them. So it's an opportunity for them to connect. So then we hired a consultant and did some research on blogs that would allow the blog to be private, to only allow mentor teachers into the blog, and to protect the privacy of the children if they ever share any pictures. And we came across two groups that qualified, Yahoo and Google, and we put it to a vote to the mentor teachers, and they voted for Google. So we will be implementing a Google group, hopefully in the fall. We're a little behind schedule, some staffing issues. So in the fall, we'll be implementing a Google group for our mentor teachers to share these exciting developments that they have. So, I'll leave that. Thank you.
Oh, we have any questions?
The mentor teacher, so basically, if you want a mentor teacher, you can apply, but it doesn't mean that they get selected for the recommendation. Second of all, the mentor teacher has to be part of the graduate program.
No.
When part of the process of selection for mentor teachers is observation by two selection committee members, they go in and observe primarily using the Harms and Clifford environment rating scales, but it's also a qualitative assessment of the mentor teacher's interactions in the classroom. And so obviously there are different levels of knowledge and sophistication within mentor teacher. You know, we have mentor teachers, we have one who's actually maybe more than one, but one I know of who's on a track for a PhD. We have many who are master's prepared, teaching at community colleges already. And we have some who are less developed academically and may really benefit from learning more about the frameworks and foundations.
So, in the local colleges, when the students are, having practicum, mm-hmm. they have to have a mentor teacher to be the one who oversees.
No, we don't have that control over the community colleges.
I know for my college, it's not really like that. So I was just wondering.
Having a mentor teacher in your practicum experience is an option for students. And so the students can go to the Lafayette School or be placed with a mentor teacher. And it is the college's decision whether, in some cases, there are a few colleges without that school who then they do their own assessment of programs and they allow students to practice in those sites or something like that. So the mentor teacher choice is a choice open to the student at the allowance of the community college. Oh, absolutely. We have many mentors work with four-year university students and high school RMP students as well.
You mentioned that your Georgia mentors have been trained in Oz and Oz.
Yes, actually, we were one of the early adopters of the PASS, and that was 2006 when we began introduced, and in 2007 then we began requiring a PASS assessment to become a direct mentor and to be recertified, which they do every 3 years.
And if we don't have one in our particular county, we can go outside of our county?
That's the wonderful thing about director mentors. Whereas mentor teachers, of course, are tied to their location, director mentors are not. And we have about half of our director mentors are actually retired. And then those who are working as kind of administrators, it's up to their availability of time. But a San Diego director mentor could mentor someone in the far north of California online, on the phone, wherever.
So you don't have to be currently working as a director?
You do not have to be currently working as a director. Yes. You have to have had experience, at least 3 years of experience being a director of a program. And you do need, to meet the application requirements and your application requirements. But it's a wonderful resource, and as many of us are getting to that age, it would be such a tragedy to not tap into that wonderful resource of retired directors to become to be a director. I did get the first part of the question. I'm sorry. Do you think it's a good? That's wonderful that you are. See, in this case, you wouldn't necessarily be able to get DPIN resources,
right,
but you could get the resources of the mentor program. So,
and I have one question on the blog. Only the current mentor teachers can log on.
When we implement in the fall, it will only be current mentor teachers, and it will be invitation only. And so, if you cease by your email address, so if you are not recertified or whatever, you would be taken off. And of course, and there will be a code of ethics that we'll be working on about the use of the material generated there offline. Is one thing that we wouldn't want to have happen, because it is the case that some mentors are more sophisticated than others in the frameworks and foundations, is for a less sophisticated mentor to say, oh, this is what I've done, and it actually isn't aligned with the frameworks and foundations, to then share it out to the world. So, we will have an in-house policy about that. Let's keep this discussion in-house.
Well, can I just keep in contact with you to see?
Yeah, please do.
Yes,
please.
We didn't have time today to give you the specifics of what qualifies someone to apply to be a mentor teacher or a director mentor, but it is in the PowerPoint that will be posted online from this conference, so you can look. We have our website at the end and our email addresses. Any questions, you can, of course, speak with us. So now it is my absolute pleasure and pride to present two of our current mentor teachers, both from the College of Marin. Susan Teixeira and Jackie and Sandy Declan, who have extensively implemented or integrated the foundations into their current practices. And each one is going to describe some things that are going on in their classroom that exemplify that. So Susan, you're going to go first. If you want to speak, I can advance the slides for you.
Okay, great. I'll give you a chance.
Give me a chance.
Hi. I am from a non-subsidized preschool. And I'm very, very lucky to have been accepted into the mentor program. I have gained invaluable skills. I have become a presenter since I have been in the mentor program. My colleagues and I have presented things, for instance, in our local conferences, the Natural Classroom. I presented wheat throughout the year, growing wheat and all kinds of things. I've presented potions for young wizards. We did some kind of a science-based exercise. We presented a workshop on Mind in the Making, Last Child in the Woods. And through my association with the mentor program, I have become familiar with the foundations and the framework. Otherwise, I would be one of those peripheral people because I don't have a larger umbrella that, because we're a private nonprofit, we do all our own fundraising. We get no outside funding. And so I would be one of those folks who would not have a clue about what's going on in the rest of the state. But luckily, I have become fairly knowledgeable, only fairly knowledgeable about the foundations and the framework. We recently did a presentation on block play, the framework and the foundations through block play. And I have extrapolated just a few things from our presentation that we're going to go over now. And I'm sure that I'm going to give you a disclaimer now. I'm not nearly as literate in the foundations and the framework as some of you may be. So I probably will not be as accurate as you are, but here we go. Language and literacy. Of course, language is one of the most crucial tools that children acquire. It's necessary for cognitive development, for reading achievement, and for all overall school performance, and especially in social relationships, language. Block play supports children in providing them opportunities for listening and for speaking. Block play supports children in the use of vocabulary and language use and grammar. Blocks support children when the child tells their thoughts about their structures, about short narratives, about what they built, and when the teacher repeats and extends. Vocabulary, you can go back one. Sorry. Blocks provide the child opportunities to expand and develop their vocabulary. Most children understand words for large categories of objects, like trucks. And the teacher can help expand the vocabulary by the larger category of vehicles. Teachers can support vocabulary by describing the things that the children notice in their block play. Sometimes relationships between objects are difficult for young children, and for instance, on top of, next to, beside of. So a teacher might notice this block structure and talk about what's on top of one block, on top of another, or next to, or beside. An older child may, the teacher might comment and expand vocabulary such as arches and ramps and symmetry and grammar. During block play, the children can use increasingly complex and longer sentences communicating with each other. They can knit two or three complex ideas in one sentence. so the teacher can talk to the children whenever possible, one-on-one. For instance, in this slide, this little girl had a rich narrative going on with all her structures. And so she was able to tell the teacher and all her friends what was going on and use correct grammar. The teacher can support this with open-ended questions. Tell me more. Why did you do it this way? What could be different? And help the child go deeper and expanding their narratives. Literacy includes both reading and writing. Literacy does not develop overnight. It comes from being talked to and being encouraged to read books, to draw and to write. Concept about prints has different aspects. Print conventions isn't one of these. Reading from top to bottom, left to right, front to back. Phonological awareness is not an oral skill that focuses on meaning. It's about manipulating different sounds in spoken language. The teacher supports this awareness by playing language games that focus on blending larger chunks of sounds, like bird seed, or smaller chunks of sounds, like k, r. Also playing games that focus on deletion of certain chunks of sounds, like playground without the play, or chin without the ch. And also teachers can help by doing songs and poems every day, including songs that manipulate sounds like apples and bananas, or woo-woo-woo-woo, all of those little verbal games. It's games through the ears. Also, transitions are a great time to play these games. When you call somebody's name, you can say, we do lots of clapping of syllables, Emmanuel, or sometimes we say, well, what would happen if I call you in a silly way and add an O, and then your name would be Lemanuel. Just fool around with it. Have fun with the language. The syllables, which are larger chunks of words, and then the onset and the rhyme, which the t-ale rhymes with p-ale, and also using alliteration, like Lucy Lockett lost her lavender locket. Uh-oh, something happened. A lot of L sounds. Okay, and with alphabetics and word print recognition, this is about recognizing mainly about names, and it's preliminary sounds, recognizing their own name, being able to name many different lowercase letters, and understanding that letters have specific sounds attached. This little boy built a beautiful structure. He lives on a hill, and he wanted to make some props for his structure. So we got out, we keep books by the block building, literate books that have signs in them. So the teacher got out the books and, well, let's make, what sign do you want? And he talked about different signs and the words associated with the signs, and the little boy picked out the word bump. And then we wrote the word bump, and the child was very excited about the word bump. But we had talked, what do you want bump? Do you want hill? Do you want bump? Well, is your structure on a hill? Does it have a bump? And we finally wrote bump, and then at the end of the day, he ran to his mother and said, Mom, Mom, look, we've written the word hill. That was just fine. This is also a picture of the integration of print recognition and writing. Writing is another aspect of literacy. This little girl lives on a horse ranch. She has stalls, and she has been writing. She's five. She writes her own name. She built a beautiful horse stall with lots of horses and lots of room, and she also needed props in her block place. So we made a little piece of cardboard, folded it in half, and it could stand up by itself, and we worked out the sounds in horse stall, and she could write them herself, and so she did. And there we have it.
Very good. And now Sandy will describe some social emotional development that goes on in the book, the foundation and Blackboard.
That's right. I use the foundation and the frameworks to a child study for a little girl in my class. But to get us started on social emotional involvement, let's change gears a little bit. And I'd like you to look at this slide and think of the child on the left as not being confident in joining a group. And he's just come into school. He sees these children playing with the blocks. And how would you advise a teacher in this situation to help this child? Does anybody have any ideas? Yes?
Probably model for the child how you can stand back and observe the choices and what other children are doing and kind of get a sense of what's happening.
Very good. Is anybody else having any ideas?
Prepare the class before the new child starts that they will have a new friend so they will know to invite and include the child.
It's really important. Anyone else?
Are there limits as to how many children may join that block building?
No.
No, okay.
Not in my classroom. Okay. I know that there are classrooms who
lock them in a space.
Yes.
I might join the child and be a co-player and model and example the giving to me, and depending on, I happen to look up for children there too, mm-hmm. in terms of where we might go, because some other children are more open to a newcomer, and I'm sorry, I need to know those. Is it four who are there?
Yes.
Four, I need to know who.
Okay. There are four girls. Okay. Okay. So I'd like to introduce you to me. This is not her real name, but. And it's not the real picture, but I did have a child in my classroom that in September was 4 3/4 years old. She was going to be 5 in December. And she had this look a lot of times. I was very concerned about her because she had an expression on her face that showed disappointment, anger, frustration about 90% of the day. She didn't get along well with her friends, and she had a hard time joining in groups. And so I used the foundations first for my conference, when I was getting ready for a conference, because I wanted to find out through the foundations where Meg should be and where how I could help her. And so I discovered that with self-regulation, she had difficulty waiting and managing transitions and also controlling her strong emotions, as you can see right here. One instance was that after rest time in September, it was a really hot day, and I gave the children a popsicle. Each student got one popsicle. And Meg got really upset because she could not have a second one. And she had stomped her foot and was going to go home and tell her mother on me. It's fine. But also, she didn't have any social-emotional understanding with other children. She'd often say hurtful things to her friends. She'd tell them that she didn't like their drawings. They were ugly. Or she didn't like their shoes or something like this. And then when they responded, either by going to tell a teacher or getting upset, there was a total lack of effect. I mean, she just didn't seem to understand what was going on. I didn't see much caring and empathy. And when she wanted to join a social situation or a group participation like the block, she'd stand there looking like this, with, you know, looking at the group that she wanted to join in with. So I talked to her teacher of the previous year, who said that she had tried to help Meg relax, take deep breaths, change her facial expression, and it really didn't work very well. So as we can see, Meg is still in the same situation. So I went to the frameworks, and one of the important things, the framework is observation and reflection. I observed Meg by herself and in a group situation, and I reflected on what I saw, and I also brought this to my team meeting. I work with two other teachers, and so we discussed Meg every week for probably about 6 or 8 weeks before I had a conference with her parents. I was intentional, we were all intentional, in our teaching. When we were reflecting, we were also thinking about what we could do to help them. And that's where the frameworks come in. They have some wonderful ideas. And it's a great resource. Some of the things in the frameworks we were already doing, such as in morning meeting, we were talking about facial expressions. We were talking about anger. We sang songs about emotions. We read a lot of books. And we also had a chart that the children could fill out each day with their name, and it would have a face on it. So if they were happy, they put their name next to happy. If they were sad, they put it below the sad. If they were angry, it was below angry. But we were trying to do a lot of things to encourage Meg to figure out what her own emotions were. Then we were also encouraged play, and that's one of the beautiful things about the foundations and the framework, is that they are very play-based and intentionally. You can do so much through play. And we did a lot of role play with puppets and with teachers. And then we provided her with support. And that included the conference with her parents. And what was interesting about the conference with her parents is her mother said that she was afraid that her child was depressed, that depression ran in the family. And I was the first teacher to bring this up. I mean, just that what I was seeing in the classroom with me. And so they immediately went and got help for her. And I talked to the street teachers, as I said, weekly about different strategies that we could help Meg with. And then we also tried to be around Meg to support her before a problem arose, and to model for her and to coach her. One of the other things, next slide please, that I did was I found something saying about how people were happier if when they tried to help somebody else out. And so another thing that I've learned from the frameworks and the foundations is involving families in the program and in our classroom. And so I started this random acts of kindness button jar. During morning meeting, I talked to the children about what I had seen that day that was helpful. I had one child that came in and was crying because her father was leaving for a couple of weeks on a trip. And another girl came up to her and said, why don't you come up on the loft and read a book with me? I had a mom who came in and talked about how her daughter, who was in my class, had helped a younger sibling get ready for school and put his shoes on for him. And so these are the kind of things that I wanted to encourage in the children. And so I told them that each time that they did something for a friend or their parent came in and said that they had done something at home, that I would give them a button that they could put in the jar, and then I also wrote it, and we had a big board posted of all the acts of kindness that the children had done. And at the end, when the button jar was full, we went and bought pizza, and we had a big pizza party and picnic out on the playground. And this is Meg today. She's much happier. She can articulate her feelings, which is really amazing. I hear her saying things like, please don't use your angry voice, or that's a mean face. And you know, it's so above where she was before that it makes me so happy. And then on Thursday, when I was at school, there was a little boy that came in, and he didn't have any modeling clay. The children at the table all had modeling clay, and she gave him hers. And she'd been working on these little round things with little eggs in them for probably about 20, 25 minutes. But the change to see that this child had wanted something and she could give it to him was just wonderful. So the foundations and the framework really work. And thank you very much.
Thank you both so much. This is what makes it real for all of us.
Do we have time for questions?
No. Sure, absolutely.
And I'd like to address it to both of you. I have a plan for this year, but I'm not quite sure how to show it to the adult students and the mentees. A goal of mine is to assure congruency between what the instructors are teaching in class and what they're seeing in the labs. And I really like the foundations and framework to be the language of our whole center this year. How do we show the mentor students and the college students, you're working on this and you showed two beautiful examples, but say they just come and they need a copy of the lesson plan for the week, or they're just at the observation window, how could I show them that from, say, their child development or language and literacy class, that they're seeing that framework through the windows? Do you see what I'm saying? Like, maybe on the lesson plan, put, say, the teacher's reading this story or doing this dinosaur. Should they put on the lesson plan, this is framework or foundation, this, so they can take their compare and contrast assignment back to their instructor and say, oh, today I saw this foundation, and the teacher did this. Are you with me?
Yes, I'm with you. And I was thinking immediately of this tool that we were given today, because this is for math, but it's got the foundations on it, and it's very simple.
That comes from the appendix.
This comes, yes.
At the back of the foundations. It lists all the foundations in all of the domains, and it's only a few pages, so you could print that off of the internet or from your actual book, and we use it a lot when we're doing these kinds of demonstrations where you don't want the whole big book. You could have something like that attached to the lesson plan.
Oh, so the adult students could say, oh, well, today on the lesson plan is this dinosaur activity, and then we could put that little piece behind.
Right, and then you could ask them afterwards what they observed and talk to them about that.
Oh, that's wonderful.
I have a similar question. I find that when we develop lesson plans or activities and try to connect it to a something from the framework, or we use more than DRDC access to the different measures, then some teachers kind of get locked into that activity only addresses that one measure. But really, of course, the activities can go almost any direction based on how you're facilitating it or what. So I was also wondering, I mean, is it better, maybe there's not a better way, but is it better to try to attach a lesson or an activity to things from the framework, or is it better to kind of educate more globally and then have people be able to intuitively, you know, make those connections?
Well, it kind of goes along with intentional teaching, so kind of both, but how do you explain it to a new Child Development 100 student?
But I think what's really important, and thank you so much for bringing up what you just did, because one of the main emphases throughout all of the volumes of the curriculum framework is this whole idea of the integrated nature of learning. And so when you're working with your teachers, students, in terms of looking at an activity, I think you're right, we shouldn't link it to any one foundation, because one activity covers so many different domain areas, the different strands, and so helping teachers look through that lens in terms of the integrated nature of learning and how one activity can cover so many different domains, social emotional development, mathematics, literacy, that is a really important emphasis in terms of how teachers look at the objectives in terms of what children are learning throughout those activities.
And in all of our trainings, we do that. We always look at the content area first, so they really get a grasp of the research and the practical application, but then we always take them through the integrated nature of the activities so that they can really be thinking about, you know, well, we said that when we did the dinosaur activity, right? What was there? Was there social emotional? Was there,
yeah,
right? Was there language and literacy? So I think you're right on.
Something we did, and I'm listening to what you're saying, so I probably should request a little more. We did a preschool at-a-glance sheet, so we took everything that we use, everything, curriculum and our guidelines, and I guess you could say we put specifics on where to put what foundations, but if you're looking at it, you're going to see it as a whole class of everything we do, so you could say it's integrated, okay? Because we did find for our teachers that they weren't getting into the books. So we wanted to be able, okay, when you're writing the plan, this is your preschool skills with plans guideline for the year. Now, you know, these are suggested
foundations, frameworks. Of course, you know, our purpose was to get them in there to get going and how you're going to use that and correlate and integrate it. The other part that we add, and you asked the question, was, well, how do they know? What's the gain? How do they know the evidence-based outcomes? And in a book called Who Am I and the Lives of Children by Feeney, actually, it's really a nice one. You can bring in and you can get them out of the frameworks and the framework primarily. You know, what are those questions that you're asking? And have that incorporated in your
journey. A companion piece of this is the faculty instruction project, which works faculty as to how to integrate the content and the concepts of the foundations and the frameworks into their coursework and teaching so that you can communicate with the instructor and know that that student was presented or you know, the work that, or the assignments were reflected in the content of the foundations and the framework. So it's also, that's another aspect of helping to make that real to the student, to have that as part of the lecture component of the practicum class. So it kind of all works together. Further questions or discussion? Thank you so much. Just one?
I think with the students, they also have to learn to observe children before they can actually figure out how to implement, what kind of activity to implement to be able to meet the goals and objectives. And I think that's one key that sometimes they don't do when they walk into a classroom. They just think, okay, this is my goals and objectives. I'm not really tying in to what's needed in the classroom for the group of children that they're working with. Because what happens is sometimes, because I work with a mentor teacher, and sometimes I see the students and they just think, okay, I better work on math, I better work on science. So they think like, okay, I better implement so I can meet these goals, but they're not really serving what the children need. So that's a piece that's very important, because with the with accreditation, they need to tie in the observation of children and what activities need to meet. And I think that's one piece that sometimes is missing, because they just think, I have to do this, I gotta meet that, I gotta do that, but they're not reflecting of what the children need, you know, that's where they are. And I think that's what piece. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Thank you very much. I know our time is getting short, but we have a few more resources to share with you as part of the overall collaborative system that I and Nancy are going to spend a few minutes on, just to make you aware. 2 years ago, or 3 years ago, the Child Development Division of the State Department of Education realized that they were kind of unable to portray in an organized, factual way the scope, the outreach, and the effects of their quality improvement program, largely because each of us at that time were collecting different data, different evaluative data. There was no way to compare them. So they have implemented a standardized profile process. So now all quality improvement programs in the state are collecting the exact same data. Last year was the first year it was implemented. There was a report issued comparing all the input from the people who received professional development, as well as the practitioners themselves. Our mentors and director mentors are also part of that overall standardized profile. The Child Development Training Consortium, and there's their website, handled the reporting of that data. It's in a PDF. That's the link to that report if you are interested. And it's going to be continuing, certainly continuing onward for all quality improvement programs. Another new initiative that is housed on CDTC's website is the training portal. Here's a brochure that describes it for the very first time. Practitioners in the state can go into one web-based, easy, user-friendly application and find out what workshops, trainings, and online higher ed courses are being given, not only in their area, but anywhere around the state. They can search on topics, they can search on timelines, and eventually it's also going to include on-ground higher ed courses. So students can know everywhere in the state what training and ongoing professional development is open to them. Again, that's also on CDTC's website, which is childdevelopment.org. And finally is the early childhood educator competencies. This represents many years of work in the state where hundreds of practitioners over time narrow down and focus on what are the skills, knowledge, and dispositions that high quality early childhood educators should know and be able to do. This is a document. There is a project whereby, again, faculty are integrating these concepts into their coursework. There is a link, again, on the Child Development Training Consortium website about the Competencies Integration Project, if you'd like to know more about that. And as a companion, there is a tool, an online tool that is being developed, a toolkit for self-assessment of the competencies. So anybody, no matter where they are in their career path in the field, no matter if they're a classroom teacher, a director, or even a support person for an infrastructure organization such as the mentor program, can use the competencies to chart their own professional development path. So these are some of the wonderful initiatives going on that, again, link us all together, link all our professional development programs together. And now I will turn it back to Nancy.
I'm going to share with you just very brief highlights of three very large initiatives, but given our time frame, do know that you can go to these websites for more information. The first initiative that's highlighted here on the slide is the California ECE Workforce Registry Pilot. This is different from some of the efforts that we've talked about in that this is not a statewide led effort. This is a locally driven effort, where they are using foundation, local city government funds, and a variety of funding resources to implement a registry in both San Francisco and Los Angeles. What's different about this registry versus what Linda shared with you regarding the participant profile data that we're collecting for our quality funded projects is that through the participant profile data that we are currently collecting through quality funds, that is all anonymous. We do not tie names, specific identifying information. It is aggregated demographic data. The workforce registry is different in that teachers and other teaching staffs within programs have this opportunity voluntarily to input all of their coursework, transcripts that are verified, all of the professional development so that their employers and other professional development systems can access this information. Now, do know that this is very much in the early pilot phase. They are just developing and refining the database, and they are slowly beginning to collect this data. Another really important initiative and a very exciting one is the Race to the Top Early Learning Initiative. California was, I believe, one of eight states here in the nation that was awarded an Early Learning Challenge Grant. And California's approach was very unique and different from other states in that we have, again, a locally driven statewide model. The statewide model entails three common tiers to develop and implement a quality rating and improvement system, referred to as a QRIS system. And this really is probably the most comprehensive initiative we have here in California, where we have this opportunity to pull all of these statewide resources together to help support quality improvement efforts. There are 17 agencies in 16 counties that are implementing this, and you can read more about that within the website that we've identified. And then the CARES Plus is yet another important resource we have here in California, funded through First Five California, which is funded through the Tobacco Tax Prop 10 initiative. CARES Plus helps support the workforce development in terms of providing incentives and other resources to pursue education or to continue to pursue ongoing professional development. The connection with the quality funded projects that we described today is that any of the professional development that CARES Plus participants attend have to be part of the quality funded professional development system. So there is that linkage so that those who are receiving stipends through CARES Plus we're ensuring that they're integrating the foundations and the frameworks within their QRIS model, as well as a number of other standards that they're looking at. In terms of group discussion, I'm sorry we won't have a chance to get there, but let me point out one other resource that we have shared with you, and it's a handout. And just a quick overview of what we've provided for you, what we've included in this handout, and we've used this on numerous occasions for various presentations and other collaborative efforts. This is just a partial list of our quality funded projects. It was helpful for all of us to come together, all the directors of these various programs, to identify all of the different, both unique and similar features of the various quality funded projects. And so I think this is a great resource. Not only do we have great descriptions about the different services, but if you flip it to the back side, this is where you can see where we have some of the similarities and the unique differences among the various programs. So this is a great resource for you to have. And then just finally, because we've been talking about the foundations and frameworks, I do want to point out another important resource that was recently released in August 2012, and this is the alignment document. And this is a document that helps to highlight how the preschool learning foundations, well, actually it goes earlier from the infant toddler foundations to the preschool learning foundations, and the linkages to the kindergarten common core standards as well as the content standards for kindergarten. So this is a great resource that really clearly highlights the continuum of children's development from infant toddler all the way through kindergarten. And I know many of you know about transitional kindergarten that's being implemented, and this has been a tremendously valuable resource for those teachers and administrators who are implementing transitional kindergarten. So with that, this is our final web page, or our final PowerPoint page. All of our contact information is here. The websites to access the information about each of our programs are also identified here. So I know this was we had a lot of information in a very short period of time, so please feel free to contact us. I know some of us have provided our business cards right here on the table, so feel free to pick those up. And any closing, final questions, something you just have to get out there before? Yes.
Just the last thing you showed, the alignment.
Yes.
Where do you get that?
If you go to the California Department of Education, just under search, I just type in alignment document,
okay,
and it will ask us, and you can download it. Just know it's about 273
yeah.
pages, so pick the sections you want.
You can also, I just sometimes Google, and I just type in alignment, and it even pops up that way.
And then just one final comment, because I heard that, I know we have private funded programs and private non-funded programs, providers, representatives in this room, and do know that through CPEN, California,